This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of My Friend Leonard by James Fry, narrated by Andy Paris and directed by Karen Zippler. This book is copyrighted 2005 by James Fry. This recording is copyrighted 2005 by Recorded Books. The author opens with the following quote from Psalm 23, verse 5. My cup runneth over. And now, My Friend Leonard.
Beginning. On my first day in jail, a 300-pound man named Porterhouse hit me in the back of the head with a metal tray. I was standing in line for a lunch, and I didn't see it coming. I went down. When I got up, I turned around and started throwing punches. I landed two or three before I got hit again, this time in the face. I went down again. I wiped blood away from my nose and my mouth, and I got up. I started throwing punches again. Porterhouse put me in a headlock and started choking me. He leaned toward my ear and said, I'm gonna let you go. If you keep fighting me, I will fucking hurt you bad. Stay down, and I'll leave you alone. He let go of me, and I stayed down. I've been here for 87 days. I live in Men's Module B, which is for violent and felonious offenders. There are 32 cells in my module, 32 inmates. At any given time, there are between 5 and 7 deputies watching us. All of us wear blue and yellow striped jumpsuits and black, rubber-soled slippers that do not have laces. When we move between rooms, we walk through barred doors and metal detectors. My cell is 7 feet wide and 10 feet long. The walls are cement, and the floor is cement, and the bed is cement. The bars, iron. The toilet, steel. The mattress on the bed is thin. The sheets covered with grit. There's a window in my cell. It is a small window that looks out onto a brick wall. The window is made of bulletproof glass, and there are bars on both sides of it. It affords me the proper amount of state-required sunlight. Sunlight does not help pass time, and the state is not required to provide me anything that helps pass time. My life is routine. I wake up early in the morning. I brush my teeth. I sit on the floor of the cell. I do not go to breakfast. I stare at a gray cement wall. I keep my legs crossed, my back straight, my eyes forward. I take deep breaths in and out, in and out, and I try not to move. I sit for as long as I can. I sit until everything hurts. I sit until everything stops hurting. I sit until I lose myself in the gray wall. I sit until my mind becomes as blank as the gray wall. I sit and I stare and I breathe. I sit and I stare. I breathe. I stand in the middle of the afternoon. I use the toilet and I drink a glass of water and I smoke a cigarette. I leave my cell and I walk to the outdoor recreation area. If the weather holds, there are prisoners in the area playing basketball, lifting weights, smoking cigarettes, talking. I do not mingle with them. I walk along the perimeter of the wall until I can feel my legs again. I walk until my eyes and my mind regain some sort of focus. Until they bring me back to where I am and to what I am, which is an alcoholic and a drug addict and a criminal. If the weather is bad, the area is empty. I go outside, despite the weather. I walk along the perimeter until I can feel and remember. I am what I am. I need to feel and remember. I spend my afternoons with Porterhouse. His real name is Antoine, but he calls himself Porterhouse because he says he's big and juicy like a fine-ass steak. Porterhouse threw his wife out of the window of their 7th-floor apartment when he found her in bed with another man. He took the man into a field and shot him 5 times. The first 4 shots went into the man's arms and legs. He waited 30 minutes to let the man feel the pain of the shots. Pain, he said, was the equivalent to the pain he felt when he saw the man fucking his wife. Shot number 5 went into the man's heart. From 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock, I read to Porterhouse. I sit on my bed and he sits on the floor. He leans against the wall and he closes his eyes so he can, as he says, do some imagining. I read slowly and clearly, taking an occasional break to drink a glass of water or smoke a cigarette. In the past 12 weeks, we have worked our way through Don Quixote, Leaves of Grass, and East of Eden. We are currently reading War and Peace, which is Porterhouse's favorite. He smiled at the engagement of Andrea and Natasha. He cried when Anatoly betrayed her. He cheered at the Battle of Borodino, and though he admired the Russian tactics, he cursed while Moscow burned. When we're not reading, he carries War and Peace around with him. He sleeps with it at night, cradles it as if it were his child. He says that if he could, he would read it again and again. I started reading to Porterhouse the day after he hit me with the tray, my second day here. I was walking to my cell and I had a copy of Don Quixote in my hand. As I passed his cell, Porterhouse said, "Come here, I want to talk to you." I stopped and asked what he wanted. He said he wanted to know why I was here and why a county sheriff would give him 3 cartons of cigarettes to beat my ass. I told him that I had hit a county sheriff with a car, going 5 miles an hour when I was drunk and high on crack, and I'd fought several others when they tried to arrest me. He asked if I'd hit the man on purpose. I told him I didn't remember doing it. He laughed. I asked him why he was here, and he told me. I did not offer further comment. He asked what the book was, and I told him, and he asked why I had it, and I told him that I liked books. I offered to let him have it when I was done with it, and he laughed and said, "I can't read, motherfucker. Fucking book ain't gonna do me no good." I offered to read to him. He said he'd think about it. A couple of hours later, he showed up and sat on my floor. I started reading. He has been here every day since. At 6 o'clock, I walk with Porterhouse to dinner, the only meal of the day that I eat. It is usually foul, disgusting, almost inedible. The meat is mush, the bread stale, potatoes like water, vegetables hard as rock. I eat it anyway. Porterhouse eats seconds and thirds and fourths, which, by long-standing arrangements, he takes from the trays of other prisoners. He offers to get food for me, but I decline. When I'm finished eating, I sit and I listen to Porterhouse talk about his upcoming trial. Like every other man in here, regardless of what they might say, Porterhouse is guilty of the crimes that he has been accused of committing. He wants to go to trial because until he is convicted, he will stay here, at county jail, instead of doing his time in state prison. Jail is a much easier place to live than prison. There is less violence. There are more privileges. Most of the prisoners know they're getting out within the next year, and most sooner than that. And they want to be left alone. Once they're gone, they don't want to come back. In prison, there are gangs, rapes, drugs, murder. Most of the prisoners are in for long stretches and will most likely never be free. If they are ever free, they'll be more dangerous than they were before they were imprisoned. They could give 2 fucks about rehabilitation. They need to survive. To survive, they need to replace their humanity with savagery. Porterhouse knows this, but wants to remain human for as long as he can. A guilty verdict is coming his way, but until it does, he'll stay here, and he will remain a human being. After dinner, I go to the payphone. I dial a number that was given to me by my friend Leonard. The number allows me to make free long-distance phone calls. I do not know where Leonard got the number, and I have never asked him. That has always been my policy with Leonard. Take what he offers, thank him for it, do not ask questions. Leonard is what I am, an alcoholic and a drug addict and a criminal, though he is not currently incarcerated. He is 52 years old and he lives in Las Vegas, where he oversees an unnamed organization's interests in a number of finance, entertainment, and security companies. When we talk, we do not discuss his business. I always call Lily first. Lily with long black hair and pale skin and blue eyes like deep, clean water. Lily, whose father deserted her and whose mother sold Lily's body for drugs when she was 13. Lily, who became a crackhead and a pill popper and hitchhiked across the country on her back so that she could escape her mother. Lily, who has been raped and beaten and used and discarded. Lily, who is alone in the world except for me and a grandmother who has terminal cancer. Lily, who is living in a halfway house in Chicago while she tries to stay clean and waits for me to be released from this place. Lily, who loves me. Lily, who loves me. I dial the number. I know she's sitting in a phone booth in the halfway house waiting for my call. My heart starts beating faster as it does whenever I see her or speak to her. She picks up on the third ring. She says, "Hello, sweet boy." I say, "Hello, sweet girl." She says, "I miss you," and I say, "We'll see each other soon." She asks me how I am, and I tell her that I'm good. She's upset that I'm here, and I don't want her to worry. I always tell her things are good. I ask her how she is, and her answers vary from day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute. Sometimes she says she feels free, which is a feeling she has rarely felt but has always sought. She says she feels like she's getting better and healthier and can put her past behind her. Sometimes she says she feels fine, that she's getting by and that that is enough, that she's off drugs and has a roof over her head. She says she's fine. Sometimes she's depressed. She feels like her grandmother is going to die and I'm going to leave her. She's going to be alone in the world, which is something she says she cannot handle. She says there are always options. She'll weigh them when the time comes to weigh them. Sometimes she feels nothing. Absolutely nothing. She doesn't talk, she just breathes into the phone. I tell her to hold on, that she'll feel again. Feel better again. Feel free again. I tell her to hold on, sweet girl. Please hold on. She doesn't talk. She just breathes into the phone. I met Lily and Leonard 5 months ago. I was a patient at a drug and alcohol treatment center. I checked in after a 10-year bout with alcoholism and a 3-year bout with crack addiction, which ended when I woke up on a plane after 2 weeks of blackness and discovered that I had knocked out my front 4 teeth, broken my nose and my eye socket, and torn a hole in my cheek that took 40 stitches to close. At the time, I was wanted in 3 states on drug, drunk driving, and assault charges. I didn't have a job or any money, and I was nearly dead. I didn't want to go to the treatment center, but I didn't have any other options. At least not options I was ready to accept. I met Lily on my 2nd day. I was standing in line waiting for detoxification drugs, and she was standing in front of me. She turned around and she said hello to me, and I said hello to her, and she asked what happened to my face, and I shrugged and told her I didn't know, and she laughed. I saw her and spoke to her later that day and the next and the next and the next. The treatment center had a policy against male-female relationships. We ignored the policy. We talked to each other, slipped each other notes, met each other in the woods that were part of the center's grounds. We helped each other and understood each other. We fell in love with each other. We were young, she's 24 and I'm 23, and we fell in love. Neither of us had felt anything like what we felt for one another, and we agreed that we would stay together and live together when we left the treatment center. We got caught with each other and we paid for the violation of the center's rules. Lily left the center and I went after her. I found her selling her body for crack and I brought her back. I left a week later and came here. Lily stayed for 9 more weeks and has been at the halfway house in Chicago for a month. When I leave here, I am going to meet her. I met Leonard 3 days after I met Lily. I was sitting by myself in the cafeteria eating a bowl of oatmeal. He came to my table and accused me of calling him Gene Hackman. I didn't remember calling him Gene Hackman, which made him angry. He told me that if I called him Gene Hackman again, there was going to be a problem. I laughed at him. He did not take kindly to my laughing, and he threatened me. I laughed again, called him an old man, and told him if he didn't get out of my face, I was going to beat his ass. He stared at me for a minute. I stared back. I stood up and told him to get the fuck out of my face or prepare to get his ass beat. He asked me my name, and I told him. He told me his name and asked me if I was fucked up. I said, "Yes, Leonard, I'm fucked up. I'm fucked up real bad. He offered me his hand and said, good, I'm fucked up too, and I like fucked up people. Let's sit and eat and see if we can be friends. I took his hand and I shook it, and we sat down and we ate together and we became friends. Over the course of the following 2 months, which is how long I was at the treatment center, Leonard became my closest friend. When I walked out of the center shortly after finishing the process of physical detoxification, Leonard walked out after me. I told him to leave me alone, but he wouldn't do it. He followed me. I knocked him down, and he got up. I knocked him down again, and he got back up again. He told me that he wasn't going to let me leave, and that if I tried, he would have me found and brought back. He told me it didn't matter how many times I left, he would have me brought back every single time. I looked into his eyes and listened to his words. He is 30 years older than me, but he is what I am, an alcoholic and a drug addict and a criminal. His eyes and words held truth, a truth that I knew and trusted more than institutional truth, or medical truth, or the truth of people who haven't seen the shit that I've seen. I went back to the center and I stayed at the center. I was leaving because I wanted liquor and I wanted crack and I wanted to die. I went back because of Leonard. For whatever the reasons, and I do not know all of them, whenever I needed something or someone, Leonard was there. He watched over me and protected me. He helped me reconcile with my family. He gave me the best advice that I was given while I was at the center, which was to hold on. No matter how bad or difficult life becomes, if you hold on to whatever it is you need to hold on to, be it religion, friends, a support group, a set of steps, or your own heart. If you hold on, just hold on. Life will get better. He encouraged me to be with Lily. He told me to forget about the fucking rules, that love doesn't come around that often. And when it does, you've got to take it and try to keep it. After Lily left, she needed money to come back and stay at the center. Her grandmother didn't have any more money. She had spent what she had to put Lily here the first time, and Lily didn't qualify for any of the financial aid programs. I didn't tell Leonard about Lily's problems, and I didn't ask him for help. He had done enough for me. The morning he was leaving, he asked to speak to me. I went to his room, and he handed me a card. It had 5 names and 5 phone numbers on it. All of them were his, he said. He used different names in different places. He said, call if you need anything. Doesn't matter what it is or where you are, just call. I asked him why there were 5 numbers and 5 names on the card, and he told me not to worry. Just call if I need anything. After he gave me the card, he said he had something he wanted to talk to me about. I said, fine, talk. He looked nervous, which I'd never seen before. He took a deep breath. He said, kid, I have always wanted to be married, and I have always wanted to have children. More specifically, I have always wanted to have a son. I have been thinking about this for a while now, and I have decided that from now on, I would like you to be my son. I will watch out for you as I would if you were my real son, and I will offer you advice and help guide you through your life. When you are with me, and I plan on seeing you after we both leave here, you will be introduced as my son, and you will be treated as such. In return, I ask that you keep me involved in what you're doing and allow me to take part in your life. If there are ever issues with your real father, I will insist you defer to and respect him before me and over me. I laughed and asked him if he was joking. He said that he wasn't joking, not even close. I warned him that I tended to cause a lot of problems for the people in my life, and that if he could deal with that, I'd be happy to be his son. He laughed and he hugged me. When he released me, he said he wanted me to go to jail and do my time and protect myself. He said not to worry about Lily, that she was going to be taken care of, that her financial issues had been resolved, that he hoped someday she would be better, that someday we would have a life together. I tried to object, but he interrupted me. He said, what is done is done. Now say thank you. I said thank you, and I started to cry. I hoped that someday she would be better, that someday we would have a life together. I talk to Leonard every 2 or 3 days. I call him if I can't get a hold of Lily, or I call him when I'm done talking to her. He always asks the same 2 questions. Are you okay? Do you need anything? My answers are always the same. Yes, I'm okay. No, I don't need anything. He offers to come visit. I tell him no. He asks when I'm getting out. I always give him the same date. He wants to have a party the day of my release. I tell him I want to see Lily. I want to be alone with her. When we hang up, he always says the same thing. Look him in the eye and show no fear. When I'm done with the phone, I go back to my cell. I do 100 push-ups and 200 sit-ups. When I'm done with the push-ups and sit-ups, I walk to the shower. Most of the prisoners shower in the morning, so I'm usually alone. I turn on the heat from multiple faucets. I sit down on the floor. The water hits me from multiple directions. It hits my chest, my back, the top of my head. It hits my arms, my legs. It burns and it hurts, and I sit and I take the burn and I take the hurt. I don't do it because I like it, because I don't. I sit and I take the pain and I ignore the pain and I forget the pain because I want to learn some form of control. I believe that pain and suffering are different things. Pain is the feeling. Suffering is the effect that pain inflicts. If you can endure pain, one can live without suffering. If one can learn to withstand pain, one can withstand anything. If one can learn to control pain, one can learn to control oneself. I have lived a life without control. I have spent 23 years destroying myself and everything and everyone around me, and I don't want to live that way anymore. I take the pain so that I will never suffer. I take the pain to experience control. I sit and I burn and I take it. I finish my shower and I go back to my cell. I sit down on the floor and I pick up a book. It is a small book, a Chinese book. It is a short book and a simple book called Tao Te Ching, written by a man named Lao Tzu. It is not known when it was written or under what conditions. Nothing is known about the writer except his name. Roughly translated, the title means The Book of the Way. I open the book at random. I read whatever is in front of me. I read slowly and deliberately. There are 81 simple poems in the book. They're about life and the way of life. They say things like, in thinking, keep to simple. In conflict, be fair. Don't compare or compete. Simply be yourself. They say act without doing, work without effort. Think of the large as small and the many as few. They say confront the difficult while it's easy. Accomplish the great one step at a time. They say let things come and let things go and live without possession and live without expectation. These poems do not need, depend, create, or define. They do not see beauty or ugliness or good or bad. They do not preach or implore. They do not tell me that I'm wrong or that I'm right. They say live and let live. Do not judge. Take life as it comes and deal with it. Everything will be okay. The lights go out at 10 o'clock. I stand and I brush my teeth and I drink a glass of water. I lie down on the concrete bed and I stare at the ceiling. There is noise for about 30 minutes. Prisoners talk to each other, yell at each other, pray, curse themselves, curse their families, curse God. Prisoners cry. I stare at the ceiling. I wait for silence in the deep night. I wait for long hours of darkness and solitude and the simple sound of my own breath. I wait until it's quiet enough so that I can hear myself breathe. It is a beautiful sound. I do not sleep easily. Years of drug and alcohol abuse have sabotaged my body's ability to shut itself down. If I do sleep, I have dreams. I dream about drinking and smoking. I dream about strong, cheap wine and crack. The dreams are real, or as real as dreams can be. They are perverted visions of my former life. Alleys filled with bums drinking and fighting and vomiting, and I'm among them. Crackheads in broken houses on their knees, pulling on pipes with sunken cheeks, screaming for more, and I am among them. Tubes of glue and cans of gas and bags filled with paint. I am surrounded, stumbling and huffing and inhaling as much as I can, as fast as I can. In some of the dreams I have guns, and I'm playing with the guns, and I'm debating whether I'm going to shoot myself. I always decide that I am. In some of the dreams I'm being chased by people who want to kill me. I never know who they are. All I know is that they want to kill me, and they always succeed. In some of the dreams, I keep drinking and smoking until I'm so drunk and so high, so goddamn fucked up that my body just stops. I know that it's stopping, and I know that I'm dying. I don't care. I reach for the pipe and I reach for the bottle. My body is shutting down rather than suffer the continued consequences of my actions, and I don't care. I never have good dreams, or happy dreams, or dreams in which life is good. I have no memories of good dreams, or happy dreams, or dreams in which life is good. When I don't sleep, I lie on my bed and I close my eyes. I think about Lily. I think about where she is and what she's doing. One of the requirements of her residency at the halfway house is that she have a job. She works the night shift doing laundry at the hospital where her grandmother is dying. She washes dirty sheets and dirty towels, used gowns and stained scrubs. On her breaks, she goes to her grandmother's room. Her grandmother has bone cancer, and it has spread throughout her entire body. She can't move without pain, and she hasn't left her bed in 2 months. Her doctor has said that she'll be lucky to live for another month. Lily tells me she's on morphine drip and she's incoherent and she doesn't know Lily's name anymore and she doesn't remember anything about her life. Her mind has been consumed by her cancer as much as her body has been consumed by her cancer. It has overwhelmed her and there is nothing left. Just a shell of pain and morphine. Just a shell of what was once a life. Lily sits by her side and holds her hand and talks to her. It doesn't matter that she doesn't understand anything. Lily sits and holds her hand and talks with her anyway. She tells her about the halfway house. She hopes that it's working and she can't wait to get out. She tells her about the job. It isn't so bad. She's certainly done worse. She tells her about me. She misses me and she wishes I were there. She hopes I still love her. She tells her about the hope of a future with me and without drugs and with a sense of freedom and a sense of security. She tells her grandmother about her fears, about the loneliness she's been alone forever. She doesn't want to be alone anymore. About a return to her old life. She would rather die than sleep with men for money. About me, she's scared that we won't survive in the world away from institutions. She's scared I'm going to leave her like everyone else in her life has always left her. About what life will be like when her grandmother dies. She's scared because her grandmother is the only person Lily trusts and the only person that she's secure with, and she can't imagine living without her. Sometimes Lily can't talk anymore, and she sits with her grandmother, and she holds her hand, and she cries. She's scared, and she can't imagine living without her. She cries. I am leaving here in 3 days. I will have served my time, paid my debt to society. As I lie here in bed listening to the sound of my own breathing, as I lie here fighting off dreams and drifting through the deepest night, I think about what I'm going to do when the steel door slams shut behind me. I am going to Chicago. I'm going to Lily. I love her and I want to be with her. I want to be with her now and tomorrow and every day for the rest of my life. I want to sit with her, talk to her, look at her, listen to her voice, laugh with her. Cry with her. I want to walk with her and hold her hand and put my arms around her and have her put her arms around me. I want to support her and have her support me. I want to stay away from drugs. I can't go back. And I want to help her stay away from drugs. She can't go back. I want to forget about drinking and crime. I want to be a good, strong, sober man so that I can build a life. I want to build a life for me and build a life for her. A life for us together. I want to give her a home, a place where she feels secure and free. That is what she seeks. She seeks freedom. From her past, from her addictions, from herself, from her loneliness. I will do anything to give it to her. I love Lily. I love her blue eyes and her black hair and her pale skin. I love her damaged heart. I love what lives inside of her, a spirit, a soul, a consciousness, whatever it is, I love it, and I want to live with it for the rest of my life, and I will do anything to make it happen. I get out of here in 3 days. 3 more fucking days. I lie in bed and I wait. In the deep night. 3. Chicago. Lily's grandmother died 2 nights ago. Lily found her when she went to visit during one of her breaks. She looked at grandmother's chest. It wasn't moving. She looked at her lips. They were blue. She reached for her hand and it was cold. Lily started screaming. When the doctors came and the nurses came, she wouldn't let go of her grandmother's hand. They tried to sedate her. She wouldn't take the drugs. She just held her grandmother's hand and cried. When the body was wheeled from the room, Lily walked with it, hand in hand, all the way to the morgue. She sat outside the morgue for the next 12 hours, crying. I talked to her the next night. She was hysterical. She was sobbing and heaving, begging for me to come to her. I told her I would be there as soon as I could. I would be out in 12 hours. She said, "Please, James, I need to see you. I need you right now. Please, please, please. I need you right now." I said, "I'm in jail, Lily. I can't do anything here but talk to you. I'm being released in the morning and I'll be with you tomorrow night." She said, "I need you now, James. I'm so scared and lonely. Please." She started crying harder, harder, harder. I tried to talk to her, but she couldn't talk to me. I told her I loved her and I was coming as soon as I could, that she'd be okay, that we'd be okay, that everything would be okay once we were together. She cried and I told her I loved her. She cried and I told her I loved her. Her crying slowed and her breathing became normal. I asked her if she was all right and she said no. I asked her if she would be okay until I got there and she said, "Hurry. Please hurry." We said, "I love you." We both said it. We hung up the phone and I wanted to say, "I love you" one more time. I hope she'll be okay. I've been sitting on the floor waiting for morning. I've been sitting on the floor waiting to be released from this place. I have stared at the wall and I have watched it turn from black to gray to white. When I hear noise, the noise of other prisoners up and around, awake and starting their day, I stand and I walk to the sink and I brush my teeth and I wash my face. I finish and I take a deep breath. It has been a long night and I'm worried about Lily. I know there's nothing I can do until I'm out of here. Nothing. I sit back on the floor. I wait. A second, a minute, 5 minutes, 10, they are all a fucking eternity. It's taken too fucking long. I wait. Once the doors open, I have an hour before the deputies come to get me and 30 minutes of release administration. I hope she's okay. A buzzer. The day begins. The door opens. I stand and I pick up my books. I leave my cell and I walk to Porterhouse's cell. The door is open. He sees me coming. He stands to greet me. I ask him if he's ready to finish. He says yes. He sits on the floor and I sit on the edge of his bed. I read the last 15 pages of War and Peace. When I'm finished, I close the book. Porterhouse opens his eyes and nods his head and says, "That is one good motherfucking book." I smile and say, "Yeah." I stand and I set the book on top of the other books, which are stacked next to Porterhouse's door. I start to walk out. He speaks. "James." I stop, turn around. "Yeah?" "Thank you." "No problem." I stand outside of his cell and I look at my friend. He looks at me. He is going to spend the rest of his life in prison. He knows it and I know it. We will never see or speak to each other ever again. He knows it and I know it. He speaks. "Be good, motherfucker." "You too." He smiles and he nods and I smile and I nod back. I turn around and I walk away. I walk to my cell and I sit down on the floor. I wait. I hate waiting. I hope they hurry. I sit and wait. I do not wait long, maybe 15 minutes, which seems like 15 hours. Two deputies show up and I greet them and I invite them in and they inspect my cell for general cleanliness and good order. They check to make sure that I haven't broken anything or altered anything or given anything away or stolen anything. They have a clipboard with a checklist. Sink, check. Toilet, check. Pillow, check. Towel, check. When they are finished checking, they shackle me and they walk me to intake release. They stand with me while a clerk looks at his computer and makes sure that today is my release date, that it's not a mistake. The computer tells him that today is the correct day, and the guards remove my shackles, and I walk through a steel door. Another clerk meets and hands me a box with my belongings. I open the box. There is a pair of jeans, a pair of wool socks, a pair of scuffed black boots, a white t-shirt, a black hooded sweatshirt, a wallet, $34, a pack of stale cigarettes, a lighter, a set of keys. I sign a piece of paper acknowledging that all of my possessions have been turned over to me. I step into a small room and take off my jumpsuit. Fuck that jumpsuit. I put on my clothes and I step out of the room and I sign another piece of paper and I'm done. A large steel door opens and I step through it. I step through another. Another. I step through another and I am outside and I am free. I take a deep breath. It is the middle of February. The air is cold and clean. I take a deep breath. As deep as I can. I'm fucking free. I walk across a short expanse of concrete. I stop at a gate, which is part of a 15-foot razor wire fence that surrounds the jail. I wait for the gate to open. It is moving too fucking slowly. I'm in a hurry. As soon as there's enough space, I step through the opening and start walking down the street. It is a barren street. No houses, no trees, no other buildings besides the jail. There are fields on both sides of the street with dead yellow scrub and drainage ditches. There is a lot of mud. I walk as quickly as I can down the street. I walk, jog, run, walk as fast as my lungs will allow. Before I came here and surrendered to the proper authorities, I went to North Carolina, where I lived before I went to the treatment center. I picked up my truck, my old blue battered truck, and drove to a friend's house, a friend who was a professor of mine while I was in school. My friend makes moonshine in his basement, and we used to drink the shine and smoke crack and get fucked up together. He watched me get arrested on more than one occasion. He was happy when he heard I was coming back to serve time, happy that I was attempting to straighten out my life. Part of my sentence was a permanent revocation of my driving privileges in the state, permanent meaning for as long as I am still alive. If I get caught driving, it'll be a violation of the conditions of my release and I will serve 3 to 5 years in state prison. He said I could leave my truck with him and he would drive me out of the state when I was ready to leave. I'm going to need someone to drive me out of here. I hope he's home. He better be fucking home. Trees start appearing. An occasional house. A school. A gas station. My lungs hurt. I think about Lily. I hope she's okay. I look for a payphone. The one at the gas station didn't have a receiver. I hurry to my friend's house. I hope he's home. I'll use his phone. I don't want to call my family or friends. There will be time for them later. I want to call Lily. I hope someone answers the phone. I hope she's there. Tree, lawn, house, fence, barking dog, rusty swing set, car on blocks, fast food, heaven, convenience store, church. They're all a blur as I'm moving as fast as I can. I look for the correct street sign. I hope I'm going the right way. Continental Avenue. Brookside Lane. Cloverdale Street. Cherry Valley Road. I'll know it when I see it. He better be fucking home. I come around a corner and I see my truck sitting in a driveway. I start running. Up the front walk, front porch, knock on the door, look through the window, nobody's home. I think about what to do. I don't want to wait. I don't want to wait. I don't want to fucking wait. No, 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 I'm not going to fucking wait. If I'm careful, I'll be fine. I'll drive cautiously, drive the speed limit. I'll be fine. Fuck it, I'll be fine. I reach for the door. It's unlocked. This is a small town. People still feel safe. I walk into the house, through the hall, into the kitchen. There's a phone on the wall. I pick it up and I dial. It starts ringing. I wait for someone to answer. There must be someone at the fucking halfway house who will answer the phone. Nothing. Ringing. Ringing. Nothing. I want to talk to Lily before I leave. I want to tell her I'm on my way. I want to hear her voice. Make sure she's okay. I want to tell her I love her. I hang up the phone, try again. Nothing. Try again. Nothing. I look for a piece of paper and a pen. I find them on the counter. I write a note. It says, "Thank you for taking care of my truck. I'll be in touch soon." I leave the note in the middle of the kitchen table and I walk out of the house. I walk to my truck. I take the keys out of my pocket, open the door, sit down in the driver's seat. There's another pack of smokes in the passenger seat. I don't know if I left them or my friend left them. Either way, it's a beautiful thing. I can save what little money I have to spend on something other than smokes. I put the key in the ignition, turn it. The engine starts. I look at the dashboard clock. It is 11 a.m. Chicago is 5 hours away. I told her I would be there by dark. I'll be early. The earlier the better. I hope she's okay. I want to hold her hand and tell her everything is going to be okay. I back the truck out, start driving through the town. The highway isn't far, I know my way. I drive just above the speed limit. I know that if I drive too fast, I draw attention. If I drive too slow, I draw attention. I'm not nervous about driving. I know the risk I'm taking sitting behind the wheel. I am making a decision to take the risk because it is worth it to me. If I sit here and wait, I will go fucking crazy with worry. I want to get to Chicago as fast as I can. If I get caught, I get caught. I'll deal with it if it happens. I roll out onto the highway. It's not crowded. I pull into the right lane behind a large tractor trailer. I turn on the radio. I find a station that has the news 24 hours a day. I haven't looked at a newspaper or watched television in 3 months. I have no idea what's going on in the world. I listen for a few minutes. Some bad news. I turn it off. I stare at the road. Time moves slowly when you want it to move quickly. Each minute is 10, each 10 a 1,000. I stay behind the tractor trailer, drive 3 miles over the speed limit. I smoke my stale cigarettes one after another after another. I think about Lily. I think about what it's going to be like when I see her again. I think about what it's going to be like when I stand in front of her door. Despite the circumstances, I know I'll have a big smile on my face. I'll knock and she'll say, "Come in," and I'll open the door and I'll step into her room. Hopefully, someone will have been sitting with her, helping her, holding her hand. Lily will pull away and come to me. She'll come into my arms. I'll close them and I'll hold her. She'll start to cry and I'll say, "I love you." I'll hold her for as long as she needs to be held. We'll deal with her grandmother and her grandmother's death. We'll get Lily out of the halfway house and out of her job at the hospital. We'll find a place to live. It doesn't have to be a palace. It just has to be a place for us. We'll get jobs, make some money, be together, stay together, live together, deal together, just be together. We'll grow old together. I cross the border of Indiana and Ohio. I smile. I'm safe now. I will not be back in Ohio for a long fucking time. I put my foot down. My old blue truck jumps, and we go from 63 to 83. I keep it at 83 because I know that if I get caught going 85 or higher, 25 miles or more over the speed limit, there's a chance that I will get arrested for reckless driving instead of speeding. Part of being arrested for reckless driving is that the trooper has the option of putting the offender in jail. If I go back to jail, even if it's for a couple of hours, I'm fucked. I could give a shit if I get a speeding ticket. I'll tear it up and throw it out the fucking window as soon as the trooper who writes it is out of eyesight. I drive 83. The miles start to add up. I see signs that have the mileage to Chicago on them. 112 miles. 88 miles. 63 miles. 39 miles. I smoke my cigarettes and I smile. I'm almost there. I smile. I turn the radio back on and I find a station that plays light hits, cheesy romantic ballads, lovey-dovey love songs. I sing along if I know the words. If I don't know the words, I make up my own. I'm getting closer, sweet girl. I'll be with you soon. Big kisses on your face. My heart goes boom. Forever and ever. Oh yeah, oh yeah. I cross the border into Illinois. The highway becomes bigger and more crowded. Smokestacks and oil tanks dominate the land. The air smells like sulfur, gasoline. The sun is starting to drop. The sky is the menacing gray of deep winter. I should make it before it's completely dark. I should be there soon. I have the address of the halfway house, and I have a general idea of where it is, somewhere on the north side of the city. Near downtown. It's a major street. I should be able to find it without a problem. I start to get more excited. I smile. If I got in a wreck right now, I would do it with a smile. If someone shot me, I would take the bullet with a smile. If I got in a fight, I'd smile as I threw my punches. I am almost there. Almost there. I love you, Lily. Almost there. I cross a large bridge. I'm closer. I get off the highway. I'm on a smaller road that runs along the edge of Lake Michigan. The lake is frozen. The ice is dirty and black. I can hear the wind screaming. I can feel it pushing my truck. My truck is a good truck, a strong truck, an old friend of a truck. My truck laughs at the wind, says, "Fuck you, wind. We've got somewhere to be. Someone is waiting for us." I take a ramp off the road into the center of the city. Towers of steel and glass on every side, crowded streets, horns. Pedestrians are heavily dressed. They lean slightly forward as they walk. They hurry to escape the bitter, bitter cold. I move inland, north and across the Chicago River. There are icicles hanging from the iron rails on the bridge, smoke and steam drifting through the girders. I look for Dearborn. That is the name of the street. Dearborn. She's on Dearborn. I see it and I turn and I start scanning the buildings for an address. I start to get nervous, excited, scared. My hands start quivering, trembling, shaking. I can feel my heartbeat increase. It starts pounding, pounding. The last time I saw Lily, we were in a hallway at the treatment center. It was the day I was leaving. We stood in the hall and we held each other and we kissed each other and she cried and told me she was going to miss me. I told her to be patient, that I would come to her as soon as I could. We said, "I love you." We held tight. We didn't want to let go. I walked away and Lily stood and cried. I told her to be strong, that I would come back to her. I find the neighborhood, which was once the most glorious in the city, fell into disrepair and is now coming back. I see the building. It is a large, stately home. 4 floors, white columns, tall framed windows, a grand entrance. It is ragged, but still gorgeous, as if in a previous life it was an embassy or the home of a corporate titan. There's a small, subtle sign in the front yard that has the name of the treatment center, and in small letters reads Residential Extended Care. I see an open parking space about half a block away. I drive down the street, pull into the spot. I see a florist at the end of the block. I fumble with the keys. My hands are shaking. I get out of the car. I walk to the florist, and I open the door, and I step inside. There's a woman behind the counter. She has gray hair and brown eyes. She's wearing a bright red turtleneck. She smiles, speaks. "Cold, isn't it?" "Miserable. You should wear warmer clothes." "I would, but I don't have any." As I look around, I take a deep breath through my nose. I let it out. Speak. "Smells nice in here." "Good. I'd be worried if it didn't." I smile. "I need some flowers. I've got $34 in my pocket. What can I get?" "What would you like?" "I don't know shit about flowers." She laughs. "What's the occasion?" "Reunion." "What type?" I smile again. I can't help it. Lily is down the street. I just got out of jail. My girlfriend is in that halfway house down the street. Her grandmother just died, and I want to give her something that will make her feel better. The woman nods. "You want to cheer her up, and you probably want to show her that you love her." I smile. "Yeah." The woman steps from behind the counter, leads me toward a cooler. The cooler is filled with flowers sitting in white plastic buckets and arrangements sitting on shelves. She opens the cooler and she reaches into the bucket and she pulls out about 20 red roses. She pulls out every rose in the bucket. She closes the cooler. I speak. I can't afford all those. She smiles. I'm having a sale. How's $30 sound? I smile. Thank you. Thank you very much. Do you want them wrapped? Is that what you do? Yes, it is. I smile again. I can't stop smiling. I'd love to have them wrapped. The woman steps behind the counter. She reaches for some white paper, pulls it from a long roll, tears it along a sharp edge. She sets it on the counter in front of her, and she sets the roses, the beautiful red roses, on top of it. I turn and I walk to the window. I look down the street toward the halfway house. It is almost dark. There are lights in the windows, on the front porch, along the front walk leading to the porch. Lily is in there, in that house. I will have you in my arms soon. Beautiful Lily. Beautiful Lily. I have missed you so much. I will have you in my arms soon. I have missed you so much. I'm finished. I turn around. The woman is holding the roses wrapped in paper, baby's breath surrounding them. I step toward her, reach into my pocket. Thank you. I set the $30 on the counter, take the flowers. The woman smiles. Have a good night. Thank you. Thank you very much. I turn around and I walk out of the shop. I'm smiling, still smiling. I start walking down the street. It's cold, but I don't feel it. I start running, gradually faster, as fast as I can. I'm running and smiling. I turn up the walk. I'm on the front porch. I open the door. I step inside. A simple foyer. Dark carpet, beige walls, a worn wooden desk, a cheery landscape on the wall behind. There's a woman sitting at the desk smoking a cigarette. She looks up at me. Her eyes are red and swollen. She speaks. Can I help you? I step forward. Is Lily here? She stares at me for a moment. Her upper lip quivers. She looks like she's about to break. Who are you? My name is James. She looks at me, bites her lip. She takes a deep breath and stands. Just a minute, please. She steps from behind the desk, walks to a door, opens it, leaves. I stand with my flowers and my smile and my pounding heart. My pounding heart. The door opens and a man steps into the room. He's in his late 30s. He has short, dark, messy hair, wears baggy jeans and a wool sweater. He has bags under his eyes, which are also red and swollen. He speaks. James. He reaches out a hand. I shake it. I'm Tom. I'm the director of this facility. What's up, Tom? Would you mind coming back to my office? Why? I need to talk to you. I'd prefer to do it in private. Where's Lily? Why don't you come back to my office? I want to see Lily, Tom. Please, James. I'm not going back to your office, Tom. Just tell me where the fuck Lily is. He looks at the floor, takes a deep breath. He looks up at me. Before I tell you, I just want you to know that Lily loved you very much. She talked about you all the time, and... What the fuck is going on here? He looks at me. He doesn't speak. His eyes are wet. Tell me what the fuck is going on here. He looks at me, bites his lip, takes a deep breath. My heart pounding. Lily... His voice breaks. Lily... His voice breaks again. Lily passed away this morning. I stare at him. I am holding her roses. What? My heart pounding. Lily died this morning. My heart pounding. What happened? Pounding. She took her own life. I stare at him. My heart. He stares at me, speaks. I'm so sorry. Her flowers slip from my hand. What happened? My heart. We don't know. Her grandmother had just died. She was very shaken. We found her hanging from the shower faucet. She didn't leave a note. I turn around. I walk out of the house. My heart. No. Suicide. It is dark and it is cold. No. Suicide. I start walking toward my truck. No. Suicide. My legs start shaking. Yes, suicide. My chest starts shaking. Yes, suicide. My arms start shaking and my hands are shaking. Yes, suicide. My face is shaking. Yes, suicide. I take a step and my knees buckle. I try to take another, my legs won't support me. I fall to the sidewalk. I try to get up, but I can't. Yes, suicide. I look around me. I'm on a street I don't know in a city I've been in twice. Yes, suicide. I came here for Lily and she's dead, hanging in the shower. She's dead. Yes, suicide. She was supposed to wait for me. I told her I would be here. She was supposed to wait. Yes. Suicide. She hung herself in the shower. I can't believe this is happening. She's dead. She killed herself. I can't believe this is happening. She's dead. I start crying. I sit on the sidewalk and I cry. It feels like there's a hole in my chest. It feels like everything has become a deep, dark, horrible fucking hole. There are tears. I shake. I lose my breath. There's a hole and I can't get out of it. I can't escape. I'm falling deeper, deeper, deeper. I cry. I can't breathe. I bury my face in my hands. I feel tears dripping from my eyes and my nose. Streaming across my cheeks, running down my neck. I was coming. I got here as fast as I fucking could. She didn't wait for me. She went into the bathroom and she tied a knot, a strong knot. I want out of this hole. I want out. I want to stop crying. She put her neck in a noose. She knew I was coming to her. She knew what she was doing to herself. She put her neck in the noose. Please, please, please let me out of this, please. She strung herself up. She let herself down. She lost the ability to breathe. No, I can't believe this is happening. No. She put her neck in the noose and she hung herself and she couldn't breathe and she didn't stop. She didn't stop. She didn't stop. Why didn't she stop? Why didn't she fucking stop? I came here to help her. I came here to give her everything. She hung herself. I can't stop crying. I want to stop crying. I can't. Hang, my beautiful Lily. Hang. I would have done anything for you. Hang, my beautiful Lily. Hang. Let me out of this fucking nightmare. Please let me wake up. Let me wake the fuck up. She stopped breathing. I'm not waking up. She stopped seeing, thinking, feeling. She stopped breathing. I can't get out. She hung herself, and she's dead. She hung herself, and she's dead. There is a church on the next block. I can see the steeple, and I can hear the bells. The bells ring every hour. I can hear them above the wind. The streets are empty. It's late, and it's dark, and it's cold as hell. I'm sitting on the sidewalk. I'm crying. I have been here for hours. Just sitting and crying. The crying comes in waves. Tears. Sobs. Screaming. The crying hurts. Hurts my chest and my face. Hurts the things inside that do not have names. Tears, sobs, screaming. Everything hurts. The same word over and over. No. 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 Crying. Sobbing. Screaming. I can't stop. I can't stop. The bells are ringing. The wind is screaming. 9 times I hear the bells. And it starts to slow. Gradually slow. 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 I stop crying. I stand. My legs hurt and my chest hurts. My face hurts. My eyes and lips hurt. I am cold. I am shaking. It's dark and I am cold and my entire body is shaking. I can see the building down the street. The building where Lily lived. The building where she was supposed to be getting better. The building where she was waiting for me. The building where we were supposed to meet. I can see the building. The building where she killed herself. The building where she killed herself. My lips quiver. A chill shoots down my spine.